I could use, you say, you'll give me 30 minutes?
No, I'm going to give you 30 minutes. You have 40.
You're going to want me at 30 minutes. I have 40 altogether.
Correct.
This means I could use the next 10 minutes to continue preparing my talk? All right. Doing the research? Yeah. If a cosmologist asked a string theorist, tell me the one most important fact about string theory that I need to know, I'm not sure what your answers would be today, but I'm fairly sure a year or two ago that the answers would have been very different than my answer. I think some people would have said, oh, the most important thing is that there are brains, and we live on a brain world. Or possibly that the, what else could it be? Brains, I don't know, that it's finite. Oh, that it resolves singularities, People are very, very interested in resolving singularities. My answer is very different. My answer is that the most important thing about string theory is the one thing that we know about string theory, that it has this incredible diversity of vacuums, environments, that the number of possible environments that string theory can describe is large. How large? Well, we don't really know how large yet. We certainly know that the number of vacuums of the supersymmetric theory is very, very large. Well, in some sense, there's only one of them, of course. They're probably all connected together. But in some other sense, just thought of as environments in which physics can take place, the number is astronomically large, continuously infinite. But if we try to give numbers to things, I think we'd all agree that the number is very large no matter how you count it. It used to be thought that there were five theories. Then it used to be thought that there was one theory connected together by a single moduli space, and so there was a continuous infinity, but a relatively simple one that could fit on a Star of David very nicely. But then when you really thought about it, and you thought about all the compactifications, this Star of David, I don't have a good thing to describe it. There's horns sticking out all over the place. You ever see the... never mind. And it's exceedingly complicated, just the moduli space of flat supersymmetric vacuums. And now we started to think about non-supersymmetric vacuums. And so far, thus far, the only class of non-supersymmetric vacuums that we've been thinking about are those that we could access from, in some sense, being near supersymmetric things. And that number seems to be prodigiously large, just not measured in the hundreds or thousands or millions or billions or trillions, but measured perhaps in the Googles, maybe even bigger. So this, I think, must be the most important thing to tell a cosmologist. Now, we don't know with absolute certainty that all of these vacuums exist. And I think Tom Banks and collaborators have spelled out very, very clearly what reservations there are about the nature of these so-called vacuums. But I'm going to take it at face value that the large number of non-supersymmetric vacuums that have been speculated about by people like Polchinski and Busso and KKL&T, that those are really there. I think there's a very high probability that they're really there, but that varies from person to person, how they think about it. But I would ask you the question, if those vacuums are really all there, how does that affect your thinking about cosmology? I suspect in a large number of cases the answer would be it doesn't at all, and that's not a good thing. I mean, this is the most primary fact about string theory, that it just has this wild proliferation of environments that cosmology can take place in. And I would think that if that isn't accounted for by the way that you think about cosmology and string theory, you're probably throwing away the most important thing, or the most interesting thing. Now, why is the number of vacuums so large? I'm just going to give you Michael Douglas and collaborators, and Joe and collaborators, Busso and so forth, have done some counting. And the counting is subtle, but I'm going to give you a unsubtle baby version of it. It's a really simplified, oversimplified description Nevertheless, I think it gives roughly the right answer, same answers that these other people get. The reason that there are so many vacuums is because the moduli space, it's not really a moduli space, but the space of configurations is rather high dimensional. The space of configurations, the way that you can vary the theory starting at any point, the number of moduli or approximate moduli that it takes to describe a region of a moduli space or a region of a theory is rather large. If you take a typical Calabi-Yau compactification, I am told, since I don't know very much about Calabi-Yau manifolds, I'm only told that the number of continuous deformations of it is roughly in the orders of hundreds, 100, 200, something like that. The number of fluxes that you can wrap on the cycles of a Calabi-Yau manifold is also in the hundreds, roughly speaking. Incidentally, I don't really distinguish very much in my thinking between the things that we usually call moduli and the things we usually call fluxes. And the reason is because one way of describing fluxes is through scalar fields. A flux, of course, is not a scalar, it's a density of some kind. But if you multiply it by the right power of some square root of g, you get a scalar. Well, you say, okay, but those scalars have to be quantized in very definite ways. Well, that you can do with a potential which just wiggles in a regular way. And in fact, that's exactly the trick that you use to describe quantum electrodynamics by bosonization. Quantum electrodynamics, which has a flux called the electric field and domain walls called electrons, is equally well described as a bosonic theory. So for my money, it's just some approximate description of near the... Yes, Tom.
One plus one.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Right, but I think in any number of dimensions, the same trick works. And so I wouldn't pay a big attention to the difference between fluxes. When thinking about the theory broadly, fluxes, Wilson loops, moduli of spatial configurations, all of these things I regard as simply continuous parameters in a space that you can move around in. And if you count them all up, again, I am told that the typical number of them could be as large as 500. Most of our intuition about all kinds of things comes from quantum field theory of a small number of fields. With a small number of fields, small number of degrees, small number of scalar fields, you expect, and what's more, renormalizable theories. Renormalizable theories with a small number of fields has at most a small number of minima, and the likelihood that those minima have any particular value, is particular apparently fine-tuned values, is not very large. So we consider things like a very small cosmological constant unnatural, technically unnatural. We even use the term technically unnatural. But I think we are going to find that in configuration spaces where the number of degrees of freedom is as large as several hundred, we have to completely rethink what we mean by natural. I will give you an example now. I have no idea if I'm going to get to the end of my talk. Just tell me when it's 30 minutes. I just thought of this example just this minute. Here's an example. If I have two atoms interacting with a Lennard-Jones potential, I thought it up, that's why it's called Lennard. Lennard-Jones potential, I'm not sure who Jones is. The Lennard-Jones potential is called the 612 potential. It has two parameters in it. It has a single minimum, and the number of minima of the potential is basically one. If you made the potential a little more complicated, there could be two. Now look at a system of 500 atoms interacting, a typical large molecule. How many minima are there of a 612 potential between every pair of atoms when there are 500 atoms? And the answer is exponentially large in the number of atoms. That's why protein folding is so hard. There are just a lot of configurations. It could be as many as two or three or four, I'm not sure what the actual number is, to the 500th power. Under those circumstances, what is natural and what's not natural, is it natural to find an energy level at exactly this particular energy level, plus or minus a tiny discrepancy? Well, when you have 500 degrees of freedom, it might very well be natural. On the other hand, if you had a small atom where all your intuitions come from, you might regard it as very unnatural. Why is it that functions of large numbers of variables have so many minima? So let me just spend one half second. For those who don't know why, usually if you ask somebody how many minima does a function of 500 variables characteristically have, they'll say, I don't know. And then you tell them the answer, and immediately they know why. So you'll know why in a second, if you don't already know why. Here's a function of two variables, phi 1 and phi 2. Let's find its minima. All right, so first we begin by thinking of the function as a function of phi 1. What is this thing? Is this a laser?
The very top,
okay. Yeah. All right, so if phi 2 goes this way, phi 1 goes that way, and we simply freeze the value of phi 2 and look for the minima as a function of phi 1, over here, over here, over here. Then we scan phi 2, and we find, thank you, that was good, a green one, excellent. Yeah. Difference between private institutions and public institutions. phi 1 runs this way. I forgot what I was talking about. Yeah. Right. These are if we plot the minima as a function of phi 1, namely parametrically with phi 2, we get some lines going through here. Of course, it could be more complicated. Two of them could come together and disappear. But roughly speaking, this is the picture. Then, if we plot the minima as a function of phi 2, scanning over phi 1, we get some lines going this way. And of course, the intersection of these lines are the true minima of the function, the true local minima of the function. How many of them are there? Well, let's suppose that there were roughly the function wiggled in any given direction over the range of interest a couple of times, two or three times, so that there was two or three minima, maybe four minima. Then as a function of one variable, the answer is four or three. As a function of two variables, it's 4 squared, and so forth and so on. And so for a function of n variables, if the function has any kind of wiggliness at all, you expect exponentially large number of minima as a function of the number of variables. This, I would say, to my mind, it took me a long time to come to this view. I resisted it very hard. I, like everybody else, was hoping that string theory would have some uniqueness to it. But there seems to be no evidence for that. And this kind of argument would tell you that even if you look at the non-supersymmetric vacuums, that the number of minima is very, very large. Okay? So that's the first thing that I think is important. Now, the other thing, which I think string theory tells us, incidentally, is that each minima, let's suppose I'm thinking now about minima with positive values of the cosmological constant, the other thing that string theory is likely to tell us is that the configuration space of all these different minima is connected together in such a way that dynamical transitions can happen between them. Some part of this space does consist of supersymmetric vacuums which have identically zero cosmological constant. But the rest of it has no particular reason to have exactly zero cosmological constant. Some will be positive, some will be negative. I'm going to focus on the positive ones. And because the space is all connected together, you can be pretty sure that none of these are absolutely stable, that transitions can happen between them. What this suggests, the large number of these things, together with the instability of any given one of them, together with the ideas of eternal inflation, which I understand you've heard a good deal about, suggest that this landscape, I call it the landscape of vacua, landscape of possible environments, becomes densely populated everywhere with very, very large numbers of what Alan Guth calls pocket universes. Alan, what's you who said pocket universes? Yeah. And a pocket universe, of course, is just a localized region of the universe which happens to be located in one of these possible minima. A very large universe may contain many, many pockets, and I'm going to argue that the number of pockets is in some sense infinite. The number of pocket universes will be in some sense infinite, and that you will have pockets of every conceivable kind. How you count them is unclear. In other words, how you count the relative number of different things, each of which is infinite, is at the moment quite unclear. And so I think all issues at the moment about trying to understand the measure on the space and so forth are to my mind, cloudy. But a huge proliferation of them is what's suggested. And furthermore, that every possible one of these minima is somewheres found, populates somewheres in space, this particular landscape. Okay. Third assumption? The third assumption, which is no assumption at all, is that we live where we can, and our local corner of the universe, our pocket corner of the universe, has to be such that we can live there. That's all there is to it. I would say these three things are the most important. Well, the third thing, of course, has nothing to do with string theory, but the two other things, I think, are the most important thing that string theory has to teach us. The rest of what I have to say is by no means new. People have thought about it before. The new fact for me is that string theory is just pushing and pushing and pushing us in this direction of non-diversity, of diversity, non-uniqueness. And at some point, I think you just give up and say, okay, they beat me. The anthropic guys beat me, and I think they're right. That's my feeling, that there's no alternative to at least a partial anthropic explanation of where we live in this. Now, two here, the eternal inflation and the development of pockets of every conceivable kind is a picture. It's a picture which follows from a kind of semi-classical description of inflation, but at the moment it has no clear foundations. So I want to talk a little bit about that, the lack of foundations of this subject. But the rest of my talk just consists of a set of questions. Oh, one other thing. Yeah, here's another picture of the landscape. It has the flat supersymmetric vacuums with various corners and so forth. This is the usual picture. And then I'm assuming now that off the supersymmetric moduli space, there is a very, very dense collection, a discretium of a very, very large number of minima that just is so large that we can't, the numbers are just too big to imagine. If you make a one-dimensional cut through this, what you might see is a series of minima, and then finally, when you get down to the supersymmetric part of the landscape here, just something totally flat, zero. And so roughly speaking, the dynamics of starting at some point will be a series of transitions. We can discuss whether there are transitions up as well as down, but a series of transitions which will populate some portion of this, eventually ending on the supersymmetric moduli space. That's a simple picture. Not right when you try to think about the theory globally, but I think it is right when you try to think about the theory locally within a given causal patch. And so that should be the evolution that you would see. If you started somewheres and popped around a few times before you fell into the supersymmetric vacuum, of course you would have very, very little probability of passing through the small number of these which are anthropically allowed. So we need a better picture than just saying we pop from one to another and then eventually fall into the supersymmetric vacuum. The better picture is eternal inflation. Remember that every one of these vacuums is inflating if they all have positive cosmological constant. And now a very crude picture of eternal inflation is just bubble nucleation. If you start with a relatively high, and of course none of this will ever answer where we actually started. I don't know where we actually started. The assumption is that no matter where we actually started, we quickly fall into one of these minima and then proceed to start inflating. So this blue region here can be thought of as some starting point, which may not really be the starting point, but some pothole in this landscape that we fall into, which inflates relatively rapidly. All right, then because of the instability of these vacuums, because every one of them is unstable, in particular to decay with small possible cosmological constant, bubbles will form. Well, here a yellow bubble formed, here a blue bubble formed. The various bubbles, the various colors are supposed to denote the various neighboring values, the various neighboring places in the landscape. So there might be a couple of neighbors, a yellow neighbor, a blue neighbor, a pink neighbor, and a pink neighbor. And then a little bubble opens up, but then in each one of these bubbles is still inflating. And so what you expect to happen, of course it's inflating in some sense slower than the ambient background, but it is also inflating. The bubble is growing on the one hand, but in addition to the fact that the bubble is growing, space is inflating. And so the yellow region can be concentrated on now, and bubbles form inside the yellow region. Well, eventually, you're going to spread out by this process, in a process called branched diffusion, or branching diffusion. It's a process in which not only do you hop from one point to another, but wherever you are, you also multiply up the number of objects like yourself. So you begin to populate the landscape. Called populating the landscape, and you can think of it as population by microorganisms, which in addition to moving from one place to another, also reproduce. And eventually, if the reproduction rate is faster than the extinction rate, the death rate, then you will simply propagate and fill up the entire landscape with little bugs or little pocket universes. Here's another picture of... and you keep doing this. If you're a particular observer, so here you are, you're now engulfed by the yellow type of universe, then you're engulfed by the green type of universe, then the blue type of universe, a particular observer, and will eventually keep doing this until they settle down either at a negative value of the cosmological constant or zero value of the cosmological constant. That's the supersymmetric moduli space. And then you're finished. Then you're finished. But the rest of the universe is still ongoing. The rest of the universe is still ongoing and still inflating. And so the number of possible bubbles is infinite, and the number in this kind of situation, not only is the number of possible bubbles infinite, but the number of possible bubbles of each kind is infinite. Right. Under those circumstances, I say we don't know what we're talking about when we start talking about measures on this space. I know there are lots of ideas about it, but I think it's still premature. Another picture is a kind of Penrose diagram. Here's the blue region. The blue region is down here. We start with a De Sitter space. De Sitter space would just look like this. We start with a De Sitter space, a bubble forms. The bubble walls accelerate out to near the speed of light. And so it goes from blue to yellow. I didn't feel like color coding this particular one. And it keeps going until you get, as I said, either to the flat supersymmetric moduli space, in which case the space-time will have to look thereafter flat, so there's a little place of flat space, here's a little piece of flat space, here's some flat space, or until it crunches because you've gone to a negative value of the cosmological constant, that's these red lines here. Eventually this becomes very fractal, with an infinite number, in some semi-classical approximation, with an infinite number of little pockets, and forms a kind of dense set in the coordinate space, but of course between any two of them there is still inflating space, and so the process both continues on and on forever from the global point of view, but from the local point of view you come to an end very quickly. So that's the setup. That's the setup and the idea. I think you all know the idea that that you simply create so many universes of every conceivable type. And the anthropic principle means no more than we simply live in environments that we can live in. That's the end of my talk. Now, no. Yeah.
Aren't all these universes cold?
All of them? No. Oh, you're thinking because bubbles form, they ought to be cold. We'll come to that if I get to it. No, that depends. That depends on the detailed nature of the landscape in the region of the bubble. If the landscape is flat and has some sort of plateau of some kind, you might wind up on a plateau where some. We'll come to that. I hope, maybe. Maybe I should just come to it since I was asked. All right, so here's an example of a one-dimensional cut through the landscape that that might be an interesting cut through the landscape. You have a series of minima, you tumble down a series of minima, and then you exit out onto some plateau region, surely someplace in this 10 to the 500 regions, you'll find something which looks roughly like this. I know they're hard to find, they're not easy to find, but I would think there are such things. A flat plateau, and then down into some much smaller value of the cosmological constant. Then when you tunnel through from here, you tunnel onto you tunnel eventually onto this flat plateau, and then the question is, can you make this broad shelf broad enough that you don't fall off it so quickly, in which case not much happens? If you can make this broad plateau broad enough, you just encounter conventional inflation over here. In some sense, things are fairly empty over here. You're in a de Sitter background, but then here's where you pick up the juice, here's where you get the entropy at the reheating. So it's just, the assumption is that the next to last event, our universe, according to this picture, will eventually go. The next to last event, the penultimate event, is one in which you tunnel out onto a broad plateau which looks more or less inflationary. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me make a remark about the high dimensionality of the space of configurations. There's one sense that I've already used it. Let me back up for a minute. There was an old theory which I always liked very much, and I think it was Tom Noddy and Michael, irrational axion. The irrational axion was simply a scalar field which had its field potential, which involved two incommensurate cosines. Very nice idea, because if you look at such functions, you will find out that they form this kind of discretuum. There's a cosmological constant or a minimum at practically every value within some band. And to my mind, that was the first example, I think it was the first example of this idea of a discretuum. But the space was one-dimensional. If you wanted to find something which is as fine-tuned as 10 to the minus 120, it probably meant you needed a volume of the space which was 10 to the plus 120 in some units. And that didn't sound nice. What is it here that replaces that? What you've done is replaced large values of the fields by large dimensionality. You've created a large volume, not by making the linear dimensions of the field big, but by making the number of fields very big. Well, we have another sort of puzzle, not nearly as extreme, which involves a fairly long or fairly large value that you need for the excursions of fields. And that's when you do encounter the inflationary region. You want this shelf to, first of all, be long enough to make 60 E-foldings, at least. But it's a little worse than that. If you tunnel through some higher region, you would tunnel through with some energy. And then it's very easy to overshoot and simply fall down, decelerate as you decelerate, but not get into the slow roll region and just fall down here. So you need a fairly broad plateau. I don't know how long. Is 20 Planck lengths enough? I don't know. 20 Planck masses enough? It depends on the details of how you got to this point here. Yeah?
But generically, this is very multidimensional. So your infinite field is running in a completely different direction from the picture that you draw.
Never trust the. Now, never mind. Yes, what Raphael says is exactly right. The actual space that all of this taking place is in a high-dimensional space. It's not one-dimensional. The question is, can you use the high dimensionality of the space in some clever way so that effectively you have a long plateau here? So here's an example. Supposing the space was three-dimensional, and I have to get, let's say, from here to here. I have to make a transition from here to here. Well, if it was a one-dimensional space, there's really only one way to get there. On the other hand, if it's a three-dimensional space, there are several ways to get there, several different trajectories, and furthermore, these trajectories are much longer. The length of this trajectory is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is it possible that there could be routes through this high-dimensional landscape which mimic a fairly flat or a reasonably flat plateau here so that you get slowed down? In other words, these would be routes through this high-dimensional landscape along which there was a relatively slow, in other words, along which you satisfied approximately slow roll conditions. When you get up to 500 dimensions, the number of routes of this type grows faster than exponential, And so you have many, many possible routes to get from here to here. All you need is one which looks fairly flat, in other words, where the last few steps are fairly flat. So is that the sort of thing you were asking about?
I think it wasn't so sophisticated, actually. It was just the idea that...
To use the higher dimensions.
When you tunnel one's flux, then typically you end up, you know, not in the minimum of the new place.
But right.
But you don't have momentum going in the direction of any flat directions you might have. But if you assume right. that there is an inflationary potential in our point in that
yes.
landscape,
mm-hmm.
then you generically don't start at zero once you tunnel into our point of the landscape, into our minimum.
Well, you start up somewhere on the potential,
yeah,
and then you roll down to them. You roll down to the inflationary place,
or you might even be somewhere in a chaotic inflation potential away
yeah.
from the minimum.
I guess.
Well, all I'm saying here is it's possible to use a high. 40 minutes.
We'll leave more detailed discussion this till the end.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I'm not going to talk about energy in De Sitter space. I'll tell you about it privately. Definition of energy in De Sitter space. Another question. Can you make transitions from one dimensionality De Sitter space to another dimensionality of De Sitter space? Another question is whether it is really true that all of the space is connected together. Supposing you plopped into a nine-dimensional or an eight-dimensional De Sitter space, does that mean you're going to stay... Eight dimensions, of course, means eight dimensions times two dimensions. I'll assume dimensionality is 10, total dimensionality. Could be other. Doesn't have to be 10, 11, or anything for that matter. We originally fall into some relatively high-dimensional De Sitter space, or even two lower-dimensional De Sitter space. Are we then dead, or can we make transitions from one dimension to another? So I'm going to give you one example of a transition that can take place between De Sitter spaces of different dimensionality. I learned about this from Raphael. It's an example in which a transition can happen from, well, first of all, generically, I'm interested in transitions of the type De Sitter space of dimensionality n times something else, some compactification space of 10 minus n. I want to go to another dimensional De Sitter space across another internal manifold. Well, here's one example. Just start with some De Sitter space in some dimension. Now, this is supposed to be the causal patch of one observer who's sitting at the center over here. This is what they see. They see a ball bounded by a horizon. I had another transparency which explained that, but most of you know this, that the De Sitter space has a horizon, every observer sees a horizon. So let's look at it from the point of view of a single observer. So here we have a De Sitter space which you could think of, the dimension of this sphere over here, plus two more. And now, what is it that happens? I want a sequence of transitions which in the end takes me to a De Sitter space of another dimension. So here's a simple one. You nucleate a black hole at the center of the De Sitter space by thermal fluctuations. This can happen. It has a transition rate which is very slow, but it happens from time to time. Now you see that you have a space that the causal patch has a different topology. It now has two horizons. And actually, instead of looking like a disk, it looks like an annulus. Well, you can now topologically stretch this without breaking or, you know, the usual continuous way. You can topologically deform it to something which is one-dimensional cross a two-sphere. Let's suppose that there was a vacuum of our theory which involved a compactification on a two-sphere. Then the two-sphere that's generated in this way could settle down, could change its radius, or its radius could vary until it found the minimum of a potential, and what you would be left with is a one-dimensional space, a two-dimensional De Sitter space, space-time, a one-dimensional space with horizons over here and over here. The reason in one dimension you have two horizons is because you have a horizon when you look this way and a horizon when you look that way. And so this is an example, a well-known example, it's called Naryai space, of a transition from one dimensionality to another. You can, Simeon Hellerman and I have been thinking about this, and we've cooked up lots of examples like this. And it does not seem like you're in any way limited by dimensionality, that plopping into eight dimensions is not necessarily a bad thing. Why do we live in four dimensions? Simply because four dimensions is user-friendly. Another issue is the only kind of transitions that you can make downward in cosmological constant. That's an interesting question from the point of view whether you fill up the whole moduli space. If you only went downward, you would have no way of making transitions to large pieces of the moduli space. But I don't think that's right. I don't think it's true that you can only make transitions downward. One way to think about it is to think about it in a single causal patch. In a single causal patch, the space is thermal equilibrium. Well, let's say it's thermal equilibrium associated with a cosmological constant at this point over here. Well, if you wait long enough in thermal equilibrium, fluctuations happen. They happen with a specific probability, which is related to the entropy differences of the two points, but they go both ways. It's going both ways, which allows it to establish thermal equilibrium. And unless there are also transitions from B to A, as well as from A to B, you would not be able to maintain the thermal equilibrium between the two. And you can estimate the ratio of rates for going one direction or another direction, but both happen. That means, in time, not only will you populate the smaller values of cosmological constant, you'll also populate the bigger ones, and then perhaps indirectly populate smaller values that were harder to access by only going down. All right, a last question, which I think is, to my mind, the most interesting conceptual question. Can you describe all of what we've been talking about within a single causal patch? I'm not going to, I have 3 minutes to describe it, I won't even try. I'm not going to try. So if you ask me the right question, I'll try. I told you I'd finish on the time.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Len. We have adequate time for questions.
Great. So we have adequate time for questions.
Can you describe what you told us about in a single causal patch?
Yeah, let's do it without the transparencies, though. Can this go up? Of course, I don't know the answer, but I can. I'm going to make a guess based on things we know. I think the answer should not be too different than the question of whether we can describe all that takes place in a black hole from the causal patch of an observer outside the black hole. Causal patch also makes sense there. Incidentally, here's the way you define a causal patch. There might be subtleties to this which I don't know about, but I'm sure that Raphael does. But what I mean by a causal patch, in particular in a space where there's a future space-like boundary and a past space-like boundary, that's the thing I'm particularly interested in, although it can also work here. You pick a point arbitrarily in the past, arbitrarily in the future, and then you draw the forward light cone of the past point, the future light cone of the past point, the past light cone of the future point. The intersection of the two light cones is this. And I know from reading Bob Wald's book that that's called the bifurcate horizon. Did I get it right, Bob? Is that called the
bifurcate?
Oh, that's the killing horizon. Okay. I've been calling it the bifurcate horizon. No? Okay. Right. But the region in here, in the interior in here, is the causal patch. All right, so what we learned about black holes from string theory and other considerations, in particular, we can take the example of ADS black holes, like this, that an observer out here has access to enough degrees of freedom that it can describe the theory entirely unitarily and that there's no loss of information back here. To my mind, what that means is something like the following. Nobody's ever spelled out exactly what it means, but it means something like the following, that all the things that happen back in here are redundant descriptions, are redundantly described. Let me say it this way, that things out here, in particular in the Hawking radiation, and things in here should not be thought of using the word and, you should use the word or, in exactly the same sense that when you talk about position and momentum, you don't allow yourself to think of position and momentum, it's position or momentum. I think what these ideas of complementarity and so forth are telling you is to use the word or. There's one description of this things going on here, which is relatively simple. Somebody falls behind the horizon here, juggling some balls, and we ask, does he get a chance to catch one? We can answer it very easily. If we looked at the Hawking radiation, in principle the same information is there, but it's scrambled in some impossibly complicated way. Well, I think the same thing should be true in De Sitter space, or De Sitter-like spaces. Let's draw it like this. That everything that takes place on the outside here is, in one way or another, but through very complicated scrambled physics, coded on the other side of the horizon of a single observer here. Now you ask, are there enough degrees of freedom? Are there enough degrees of freedom in this single causal patch here to describe everything that takes place here? And the answer is yes, because these causal patches always end up with zero cosmological constant. In other words, they always end up being described by infinitely many degrees of freedom. The number of particles, when we make our final exit into, perhaps into flat space if we're lucky, we will see a flat space which is a negative curvature FRW, that's one example, and that's a space which is infinite. The space is infinite and we will see more and more and more particles come into the horizon. And I would argue that that the infinity of particles that's eventually seen in this little hat region here, that infinity of particles is sufficient to, in some way, encode everything that takes place behind the horizon. Now, again, this is the mystery of horizons, which we don't understand completely, but I think there's no particular reason to think that you can't encode everything in one patch.
So everyone seems to agree that what they'd hoped string theory would do was give one theory or something like that.
Yeah,
so
that's by no means ruled out. I'm giving you a pessimist view of the situation. Okay.
If you think this has happened, then maybe another interpretation of string theory has failed, and it's time to find something better.
You're asking a question or are you making a statement?
What do you make of that?
a better theory.
Yeah, look.
Well, what I would make out of it.
That's not going to happen.
Yes, I after thinking about this for a couple of years, I'm beginning to think this is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Cosmologists have been telling us for years, perhaps this is a way to think. String theory appears to be the uniquely special theory which has this degree of diversity. So perhaps it's a good thing. It also explains another fact. It explains the fact that we've had such a hard time trying to find the right theory of elementary particles. What it says is that we are living in a gigantic haystack with only one needle, a haystack with 10 to the 500 straws, and that could be the reason why it's been so hard to use the theory. On the other hand, I actually don't think it's all that hard either. I mean, because...
Okay, we'll take a question from the back.
But Michael Douglas can tell you how hard it is.
But Lenny, there's one observational fact which should give us some pause, perhaps, and that is the fact that we're all here, and the protein...
I recognize a voice, but I can't quite place the face. Who is it?
Clifford! Never mind. That's not important. The important thing is that we're all here, and the protein the protein folding problem which you alluded to exists.
Yes.
And so I have some pause here. Why is that not a counterexample?
Yeah.
We successfully come up with unique vacuum states, all of us, independently, every time our proteins are doing some repair or as we develop ourselves. But the protein degeneracy problem, vacuum degeneracy problem, is huge. So
yes.
Is that not a we might learn from biology, that this is a counterexample?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I understand that there's an analogy with the protein folding problem, but I don't quite understand the question.
So somehow, unless we invoke a new sort of anthropic principle to explain our cells in the room, etc., we must assume that there is some nice, but as yet not fully understood, physical mechanism which allows the huge vacuum degeneracy problem
to be
protein folding to be solved. So, so maybe string theory.
It's called the theory of evolution. There's both number of configurations and also history. How did you get to be the way? How did things get to be the way they are? Things could be very improbable because there are simply a very very large number of possibilities, or because it's very hard to get to them from one way or another. So I would say you have something else going on in biology, which is a history of natural selection. I personally don't believe in the theory of natural selection as governing cosmology.
I'm not talking about that. I'm saying take two identical people. And the protein, history. The protein folding problem is being solved right at this moment
by the proteins.
By the proteins. They don't know about the history.
Yeah.
So I'm saying I'm not invoking a new mechanism. I'm simply saying that there is a mechanism as yet undiscovered which allows them to manage to do that. So maybe the same thing is said to be true for.
Okay, but would you also agree that that for every way of folding proteins that leads to a possible biology?
Good.
That some creature has probably found that niche?
That may well be true, but nevertheless, we are independent organisms, you and I.
But we're different?
But we're different.
Yeah.
But actually, our proteins manage, forgetting the whole infinite number of universes with different organisms with proteins folded different ways, or mad cow disease, which is an example of the wrong folding. I say with patriotic thinking. nevertheless, just looking at the problem of you and I, our proteins managed to find the same vacua.
Not exactly.
Close enough.
Close enough. That's
over
exactly
and over.
Right. But right there are probably plenty of collections of 500 atoms out there, or 10,000 atoms, which are different. So if we look at the entire environment that we live in and take every set of 500 atoms. Why do I say 500? I don't know. How many atoms are there in a DNA? 10,000, more than that. I'm not sure how many. I don't know. Take that many molecules, or that many atoms, and ask how many of them are found in the configuration that looks like a livable molecule. The number is exceedingly small.
I think we have two more compelling questions.
Two more compelling questions.
Lenny, you seem to have described the landscape for an empty universe at zero temperature. In other words, when you have your picture of the slow roll and then you fall, where did you fall before the QCD phase transition?
QCD?
To something
QCD
which had a
here.
Cosmological constant of lambda. Where did you fall?
Where did I fall?
Plateau.
From here.
Yeah, from the plateau, down.
Slow roll, then down to here.
Now, you didn't go directly to almost zero cosmological constant because you had a temperature.
Yeah, we couldn't.
Therefore, there was a QCD scale cosmological constant.
So
the universe had to know precisely where to go in such a way that just after the QCD transition,
the
cosmological constant became
care
zero.
Of it. You can't live in a world where the cosmological constant is more than 10 or 15 or 20 times larger than the cosmological constant that we experience. There could be lots of universes out there which went through something very similar to this, and then a QCD transition which led to a QCD scale cosmological constant. They're forbidden. They're out.
Okay. What I'm saying is that you should make your discussion of vacua in a universe which is not empty. And I think all the discussions on vacua have been done for an empty universe.
I see Raphael getting very agitated.
We have one other question over here.
Well, Raphael was going to answer the question.
He was going to answer the question.
Yeah.
You can address what you
want.
So in the models with many vacua, such as the ones that Joe and I study, you typically tunnel, the last tunneling comes from a stage where you have an enormously large cosmological constant. And so the tunneling is like a big bang for the universe that we ended up in. So you're typically at a very high temperature when you do that. You end up somewhere in a complicated landscape.
You describe your landscape at high temperature.
Well, you do effectively. I mean, the calculation of these tunneling rates takes that into account.
But in vacuum, that would be really fine for final temperature.
Yeah, as Lenny said, it doesn't matter.
Sorry.
One other group of these.
Poor Willie.
So, let me go to the example of the 500 atoms.
Yeah.
We know systems with 500 atoms or many, many more atoms, and we don't use anthropic reasoning to solve them. In fact, there are quite good predictive theories to solve systems of 500 atoms and more.
Yep.
So why in this
Not every case, system of 500 atoms.
Not every system, but there are many systems of 500 atoms that you can develop theories for and solve them.
Next.
So what's the difference between the 500 atoms and this number of these spaces with a large number of fields? And
there may be regions in the landscape which are beautifully solvable. For example, if you start on the supersymmetric moduli space with some torus, you might be able to analyze it right through to the end under the assumption that you don't have enough energy to flop into one of these other vacuums. There may be analyzable regions.
Okay, we're going
to There's no reason to think ours is one of them, that's all.
One more word, William, and we'll move on.
I had a teacher that taught me string theory. His name is Leonard Susskind.
Right.
And he used to beat me up when I asked him questions that had no operational meaning. I had to ask S-matrix questions.
Yeah.
And have you thought about how to even think about this in this context?
I have thought about it. I've thought about it. And you know, I think this is better discussed with anybody who's interested at lunch. That's what I prefer to do, because the story is a little bit long, and it would be better to, but it is, I think personally it's the most interesting question, how to describe these ideas within the context of string theory. Absolutely.
Excellent. So those interested will convene at a very large table with Lenny at lunch.
For a very short conversation.
Well, let's give one more big hand here.